today. My name is Julie Evans. I'm the Chief Executive Officer of Project Tomorrow. And we're here to obviously release the latest findings from our Speak Up 2010 National Research Project. This particular briefing is focused in on our teacher, librarian, and administrator data. So thank you so much for joining us today. Let me take you through our agenda. I'm going to give you a little bit of an introduction to Speak Up, just in case you're not familiar with it. And then we'll hear some other welcoming remarks from Dr. Catherine Burke, who I will introduce her to you in just a couple moments. She's at the Tiger Woods Learning Center. Then we're going to walk through the release of the findings. And we're going to do that interactively with our wonderful panel discussion that we have. We have some fabulous panelists that are going to share some of their insights with us as well. But then we'll have plenty of time for Q&A and comments and your thoughts and your insights as well. So I believe that we put together a really nice program for you today. And again, I do want to thank you for joining us. So the types of questions that we're going to be addressing today are around these particular themes. So how are today's teachers, librarians, and administrators enabling, engaging, and empowering student learning through the use of technology? How close is the educator's vision for using technology within learning to the student version? We'll talk a little bit about that student version or that student vision. But are they in sync with one another, or do we still have a disconnect? We're going to talk specifically about some of the emerging technologies. And this year's report focused in on three emerging technologies: mobile learning, online and blended learning, and digital content. And so we're going to look both at the benefits from the administrators, teachers, and librarians' point of view, as well as some of the barriers and obstacles that they say are standing in the way of greater adoption. And then we'll end up with talking about that ultimate school, which is one of the favorite speaker questions from each year. What types of technologies have the greatest impact on learning? So we'll get the perspective of the students as well as the educators. So let me give you just a little bit of background on Speak Up in case you are not familiar with it. It is an annual national research project. It's conducted through online surveys and focus groups. It's available to every K-12 school or district in the country to participate. Public schools, private schools, magnet schools, charter schools, online schools, virtual schools. Did I miss anybody? Parochial schools. Whatever type of school you might possibly have, you're eligible to participate in the Speak Up. What we do is that we take the national data, aggregate it into a national report, such as what we're sharing with you today and in this briefing, but we also give back all of the local data to the schools and districts to participate. And that's really, if you were to ask me, what's my favorite part of Speak Up? It's the fact that the data goes back to the schools and districts, and they can use that data to impact their policies, their plans, their community engagement, what they're doing with their students and their teachers. We also share a lot of the data with the states as well. We're going to hear a little bit more about that in our panel. Types of questions that are on the survey are what you might expect. It's about learning and teaching with technology, all the ranges associated with that. We do ask specific questions of different audiences. So if you were with us when we talked with the students, we asked students very specific questions about their 21st century skills. We asked parents about internet safety. We asked teachers about professional development. We asked all the respondents to comment on some of those emerging technologies that I mentioned. And we also asked all of the different responding audiences to tell us how they would design that ultimate 21st century school, classroom, learning space, whatever you might want to call it. What types of technologies would have the greatest impact on learning? And so I'm going to be sharing that with you. We started this project in 2003, so we have a little bit of history of doing Speak Up and doing the briefings as well. Since that time, we've had about 2.2 million online surveys that have been presented to us, as you can see, from about 30,000 schools. I should note that not only are schools participating in the United States, but actually participating all around the world increasingly, and so we're getting more and more attention, and that's starting to set up a really nice, interesting situation for doing some comparative data analysis. The Speak Up survey is facilitated by Project Tomorrow. Some of you may still remember us under our old name, MedDay. I don't know how much longer I have to keep saying that, but there's always someone in the audience that goes, ah, yes, I remember MedDay from the school winery days. We are particularly have a strong interest in science, math, and technology. We have some wonderful partners that facilitate the opportunity for Speak Up to be known by all the schools and districts around the country. And some of our partners are here with us today, so I just want to recognize some of our nonprofit partners. Allison and Matthew are here from IMACOL. It's wonderful to have you here. Thank you so much. much. Leslie and Don are both here from ISTE. Great to have you here as well. I'm not sure if any of our other nonprofit partners are here with us. We also have some fabulous sponsors that, of course, underwrite this opportunity and make it possible for all of us. So Sarah is here with us from Blackboard. Thank you, Sarah. Meredith is here representing CDWG. And Carrie. Yes, Carrie, nice to see you too. As well as our good friends are here from Smart, Tara, who's sitting right in front of me, and Eric over there. Thank you, who are here from Smart Technology. We also have a wonderful opportunity to use these fabulous 21st century tools today, and you're going to see how we're going to integrate those into our Let me introduce you to Dr. Kathy Burke, tell you a little bit about her, and I'm going to have her come up and give us a few little welcoming comments as well from her point of view. Kathy is the Executive Director and Vice President of the Tiger Woods Learning Center Foundation, both with locations in Southern California as well as here in Washington, D.C. Prior to joining the Tiger Woods Learning Center, she was a middle school principal in Southern California. Her school received the California Distinguished School Award, and she was recognized for her leadership by the Council for Special Education. She sits on the Department of Education Leadership Council for the University of California in Irvine and the California State University of Fullerton. Here in Washington, D.C., she's on the Board of Trustees for the Cesar Chavez Charter Schools for Public Policy. Her doctorate in educational leadership is from the University of Southern California, the Rozier School of Education. And Kathy serves on a number of boards of directors for youth development organizations as well as education organizations, including the board directors of Project Tomorrow. So that's why I'm especially pleased to have Kathy join us here today. So Kathy, come on up.
No, it is working. I'm just standing there, but you can stand on the side of the room. Right there.
Sure.
There you go.
My voice is a little
hoarse today.
Okay,
so I guess not.
Maybe not. I'll give you my outside voice then. I apologize for my horse people, my hoarseness a little bit today. Good afternoon, and on behalf of the Project Tomorrow Board of Directors, I'd like to welcome you to the 2010 Congressional Briefing for Speak Up. Now, oftentimes education is criticized for not seeking input from constituents before legislating reform. It may seem like an insurmountable task. I mean, if you think about it, you know, who has the time and how is it possible to collect thousands of pieces of data to actually inform discussion and create landmark legislation? Well, and, you know, for Speak Up, for the past 8 years, it's exactly what they have been doing. They've been asking questions and collecting literally, and I just corrected this, millions of data points around how students, teachers, and parents envision the use of technology to not only support education, but also to innovate it. I know that Julie will do a great job of synthesizing this most recent report for you, but let's not end the story here. I attend a lot of these events, like I'm sure many of you do. The action item here is really that we need to activate. You know, what are you going to do with this report? And I challenge you, as a member of the board of Project Tomorrow, as well as an educator, to really think about what are you going to do with this data and what can you do with this data to improve and inform education and make it better for the kids. They deserve it. We deserve it. And if there's anything, I know that Project Tomorrow staff, the board of Project Tomorrow, and myself are more than happy to have that conversation with you and really try to be creative. And let's really start moving the needle. We've done a great job in education. There's amazing reforms that are happening. But let's not let this fall through the cracks. You know, let's really take a listen today of the information that's being presented, and let's activate it. I know that by working together that we can make a difference. So thank you so much for taking the time to be here this afternoon. I hope you enjoy the presentation, and I'll be here throughout the presentation and afterwards for that talk. Thanks so much. Good luck.
Thank you so much, Kathy. Great having you here. Representative of the board as well as from your own work with the wonderful work of the Tiger Woods Learning Center. Okay, so let's get into it. And as I said, we're going to be talking here today about the teachers, the librarians, and the administrators, David. Now, that librarian, David, is really interesting because this is the very first year that we've done a specialized Speak Up survey for librarians. And so I think it's one, a recognition of the increasing or emerging and increasing role of librarians, particularly around digital content. I think it's also important to look at, as we do with all of the other side, I'll introduce them to you as we're coming up. So right here on my right, Camilla Gagliola, who is the Jamestown Elementary School, just right near here. She is the instructional technology coordinator at Jamestown. So next to her is Angela Foreman. Angela is a special education teacher at Jamestown Elementary School. And so we're pleased to have both of them here. So that's kind of my Arlington area. You need to make them so far away. On this side, Jamie Moore is the director. And, oh my gosh, Jamie, you have such a long title. I have to read the whole thing.
It's technology and school libraries. That's good.
There we go. Instructional technology and school library media with the Maryland State Department of Education. And Jamie is a longtime participant from a state standpoint in Speak Up. And so it'll be very interesting to get some of your perspective. Next to Jamie is Ryan Imbrioli. And Ryan is with, now Ryan, I'm going to get this right. I've been practicing. PAPSICO. PDAPSICO High School in Baltimore is part of Baltimore County Schools. Ryan, it's nice to have you here. And Jennifer Maldonado, who Jennifer has a long title too, I'm going to get her title right, Educational Specialist for Secondary Level Libraries. And Jennifer is with Fairfax County Public Schools. So as you can see, we have a nice representation in terms of the different populations that we surveyed this time, and we're going to have some really interesting conversations with as we get into this. So the data that I'm sharing with you today is from last fall. The surveys were open last fall. We had about 380,000 surveys that were submitted to us nationwide. And you can see the representation here. It's about 35,000 teachers, a little bit over 2,000 librarians, about 3,500 school and district administrators, that included principals as well as district staff. And then as a separate survey, a special survey also for technology leaders, about 1,300 technology leaders, they were almost all exclusively school-level technology coordinators. About the schools that are in the Speak Up database, remember I said it's eligible for any school or district to participate, so it's important for us that we do an extraordinary outreach to make sure that we have good representation. And every year since we've been doing the survey, we've had about a third in terms of urban, rural, and suburban, and then also because of the outreach specifically done to some of our partners, we always have a high number in terms of Title I eligible schools and the majority minority schools. And we disaggregate all of that data specifically and look at it. Okay, so all of this Speak Up data that we're going to talk about today that's in your report, that's on our website, what does all of that mean in terms of the future of libraries? I think there's a couple key things that I want to bring up as we're getting started. The first one has to do with the students, and this is why when we did our student presentation in terms of student database in April, we focused in on this. The way students are talking about their desires, their aspirations for using technology is actually a very strong reflection of how they want to learn in general. So if we take sort of the technology piece off of it and look specifically at what students are telling us about the way they want to learn, we can really learn some very, very interesting things. We also have found, particularly in this year's data, that educators very specifically have the potential to do this enabling, the engaging, the empowering. And so we're going to talk today not only about that potential, but what's holding it back? Where are those barriers and obstacles? And then finally, one of the things that we've been somewhat famous for in terms of our data analysis is that looking both at the synergies and the disconnects, we can really start looking at how we create that shared vision. So understanding where everyone is coming from is a nice place to start. And as I mentioned before, for the last year and a half, we've been talking about this uniquely student vision of the use of education technology. And we framed it around three specific elements or components: social-based learning, untethered learning, and digitally rich learning. Now what we did in our report on April 1st when we released our student and parent data is that we went in depth into those three components, the socially based, the untethered, the digitally rich, and did a comparison of those student vision concepts across the three indices of those emerging technologies, mobile learning, online blended learning, and digital content. We had a wonderful congressional briefing up here on April 1st. I know some of you were with us. And a fabulous panel of students, Bethany and Will, I'm not a student. The rest are our wonderful students that share their own perspective. today's report is, as I mentioned, looking at the educator side of things. And what we're going to do in today's presentation is I'm going to give you a little bit of a glimpse inside today's classroom, just from some of the data findings that we have. And then we're going to take a deeper dive into mobile learning, online and blended learning, and digital content, and then end up with that vision for ultimate school. Now, we're going to do things a little bit differently here than some other standard briefings. What we're going to do is that when we go through those emerging technologies, we're then going to take a stop after each one, have a discussion with our panelists, and then we'll go on to the next one. So let's take a look inside today's classroom, and let's share a couple interesting things that we got from our data this year, documented in the report. We did see this year a dramatic increase in educator interest in leveraging education technology more effectively. We attribute that to three key factors or elements that are happening right now. The first one is that more and more educators are actually becoming tech users themselves. We see that in the data in terms of the teachers that have smartphones, the administrators that have smartphones, teachers that are taking online courses. We're going to talk all about that. So that personal familiarity that educators are now having with the technology components is actually driving them to think more creatively about how to effectively leverage that within the classroom. We also have, and we documented this in our first report, much more increased student and parent demand for more effective use of technology within learning. And that, of course, is driving some interest at the school and district level. And then thirdly, and no surprise to anyone here in this audience, those ongoing budget crises, our financial woes, is actually forcing schools and districts to think differently about many of the processes that they have. Schools and districts are telling us that they want to have a way to better leverage the technology that they already have, how to be more efficient with it, how to be more effective with it, and how to meet some of this increased student demand. So we're going to keep all of those in mind as we go through our conversation here today, because those are really the underpinnings, we believe, for this increased interest this year. One of the things that we did see is that across the board, teachers, librarians, and administrators very much value the effective use of technology as being important for student success. Now, we see a couple things that sort of jump out, and we said, hey, maybe a few as well. We see here, this line right here is librarians. So how interesting that of the three audiences that we focused on this year, that librarians should actually be the ones that rate the effective use of technology as being the most extremely important. We're going to talk more about that role of librarians here in just a moment. Now, that's not to say that all of the groups don't consider it important. We just thought that was particularly interesting that the librarian number popped right up. We asked administrators a really interesting question. It was the first time we asked it this year. We gave them a list of all of the different concepts, ideas that are being discussed in education to impact student achievement, and said, which one of these do you think is going to have the greatest play in your own particular district? And what was really interesting to us is that universally across, whether it was district administrators or principals, the idea of increasing teacher effectiveness came out as number one. So that one wasn't really surprising. This idea of incorporating 21st century skills into curriculum was one that we thought was really interesting. And then we also thought it was equally interesting that in the number three position was this idea of leveraging technology more effectively and at the same time connecting or reconnecting parents into the learning process as well, and being able to most effectively leverage parents into that conversation. Now, we asked teachers, so how are you using technology to facilitate learning? And this particular chart, I know there's a lot of data there, is actually in your report as well. One thing I want to point out to you is that this column right here, this is 2008. I know it's a little bit hard to see. This is 2010. And this is indicative of many of the ways that we do the analysis, because we look at changes over time. So there's a couple things that jump out at me. It'd be interesting maybe to get some of your perspectives at the end. We see some things that did not change from 2008 to 2009. So this idea of setting student objectives, the idea of providing feedback to students using technology to do that, and the idea of tracking, tracking effort to achievement using technology changed a little bit, but not too much. Yet we saw huge increases here, for example, in the idea of using technology for homework and practice, which is considered one of the more simplistic or less sophisticated uses. So on one hand, we're glad that the teachers are using the technology more. What we want to see is more of this type of usage, because that talks to us more about sustained use of technology, not episodic or lesson plan development. Now the next part what I want to share with you is that we've, over the last couple of years, been asking teachers, what's the impact of technology on your students? What's the impact of technology on you as a teacher in terms of your own effectiveness? So from the student side, and we've divided up for you here today, elementary school, middle school, and high school teachers to look at the different perspectives, is that we see across the board, all the teachers say that it does increase motivation of the students. In fact, the elementary students were even a greater number than the middle or high school students in terms of that motivation factor. We see some other things come in as well. The teachers believe that the students are developing better creativity skills, they're doing more collaborations, there's increased classroom participation through the use of technology. And then when we look at the impact of technology on their own effectiveness, the number one and number two that come up for us across the board, no matter what the assignment is that the teacher feels they're more productive through the use of technology and better organized. After that, we have sort of an interesting setup of different things to get beyond that own personal productivity. The teachers feel they're creating more relevant lessons, more interactive lessons through the use of technology. I thought it was very interesting that we're up to about a third of teachers are saying it's easier to assess achievement now because of the use of technology. So we are starting to see some, at least on the value proposition side, some movement in terms of the teachers' statements about the value of technology. We asked administrators, so besides funding, because we know that that one comes up as number one anyway, what are your top tech challenges today? And this idea of having the availability of technology for student use and staff professional development are actually the number one and number two every year that we have asked it. That has not changed over time. The one that has started to change over time, which I want to bring to your attention, are these two last ones right here. And the list is a much longer list. I only gave you the top five. We think this one in particular is very interesting. You know, for years we've been talking about the digital divide, equity issues. This is the first time we started seeing equity issues jumping up on this list from administrators. I'm going to share with you what our interpretation is of that. I'd be interested in what yours might be at the end of the program as well. As our classrooms are becoming more digital, and there's much more digital learning that's happening in the classrooms, whether that's e-textbooks, whether that's online classes, the use of school portals that have grades and homework, suddenly now we have much greater interest in the equity issue than we ever had before. Because now we're starting to realize that as we're getting much more dependent on the technology, we're being more and more concerned about the students that either don't have broadband access at home or maybe don't have access to some of the tools that we're trying to start incorporating into the classroom. We think that's really interesting. And then, of course, this idea of evaluating emerging technologies. How do I know if I want to put in place a mobile learning project? How do I know what types of digital content I should be bringing into the classroom? How do I evaluate the quality of any one of those? How do I evaluate or develop what my own mission or vision is? And that is what really led us to the next part of our program, which is looking at those three key trends. Remember, we're going to look at mobile learning, online and blended learning, and digital content. Okay? So our first stop here is on mobile learning. And one of the things that we're going to do as part of our presentation to keep it nice and interactive is that we're going to have an opportunity for you to test your speak-up knowledge. Now, I know that you're not all experts in the speak-up knowledge, but what we want to know is kind of what your view is on some of the areas. If you've been in our briefings before, you know that we've done this type of thing before. So what we're going to do is that we're going to use your own smartphones. This is some new software from Smart Technology. So if you have a smartphone and want to, don't worry, we're not collecting grades or anything, and there's no prizes, there's no next steps associated with it. So we're going to have you log into the assessment once we start, and if you want to go ahead and get your browsers running, the website will be response.smarttech.com. Okay. Okay, so this is going to be our question, our first question for you. Tara's going to make sure she gets our number down, right? Okay, so our first question is, what percentage of teachers say they use the cell phone application to be better organized themselves? So this is, again, from our teacher poll from last fall.
When you get to this website, the assessment ID is the number that I just wrote on the following page that I'll bring back up. You will not need a student ID number, but basically you're going to click the enter the assessment ID and click sign in, and then you'll receive the question, and that's how we're going to gather the data from. If you're having an issue, you just raise your hand if you have an issue.
Okay, we're starting to get some responses here. So what percent of teachers say that they use the cell phone application to get better organized? Is it 10%, 25%, 33%, 50%, or 62% of teachers?
You do have three questions, and we will ask that you only answer the first question, and then we're going to talk about that. And then Julie will let you know when we're ready to move on to the second question. So if you already move to the next question, just kind of sit tight on it for a moment if you don't mind.
Okay, so you can see here, a couple different responses coming in. About a third of the group also thought it was C. There was a smaller group that thought it was D. The actual correct answer is 25%.
Yay.
So congratulations, everybody. 25%. It actually was librarians was 33%, and administrators were 50%. So 50% of the administrators in our poll said they use some sort of a cell phone application to stay better organized. Okay, moving right along here. One of the things that we talk about with the student data is what access students have. What access students have to different types of devices. So what I pulled for you as a comparative was what middle school and high school students told us was in terms of their personal access to smartphones, MP3 players, and iPads, and then compared that to teachers and administrators. Going back to that point that we talked about before, where a lot of our educators are becoming more technology enabled than ever before. So what was interesting here was that, in fact, the same percentage of teachers and high school students say they have smartphones at this point. Administrators actually a little bit higher, and 58% of administrators have some type of smartphone. Our administrators and teachers are still behind students in terms of wearing earbuds to listen to music, as you can see in terms of the MP3 player. And then what we also thought was really interesting, because this is the very first time that we've ever asked, obviously, about iPads or tablets, was that 18% of administrators told us that they already had a tablet or an iPad that they were using as part of their professional work. So we thought that was really interesting as well. The other thing that we did is that we asked administrators, so what do you think are the benefits of mobile learning? What type of things do you think would be beneficial for students, in particular for mobile learning? And we did a timeline from 2007 to 2010. So you can see, just looking at the graph, the dark line is the 2010, that the value proposition from administrators for using mobile learning to engage students, to extend the learning day, to personalize learning, has been on a steady incline right from the beginning. Additionally, we asked teachers, understand the reality of the classroom, what concerns do you have about using mobile devices in the classroom? And it shouldn't come as a surprise to anyone here. that this idea of the devices being too distracting. So on one level, they're so compelling and interactive and engaging, but then on the other level, it's this idea that they are too distracting. We also then last year's survey, we asked administrators, how likely are you to allow students to use their own mobile devices this year? And if you were with us or you saw our first report, you'll see that 2/3 of administrators told us that they were unlikely to let their students use their own devices this year. And so we asked administrators, so what's preventing you from doing that? And disaggregated, both looking at school principals as well as district administrators. Again, you'll see this as a reoccurring theme through the data. The number one response that came back from the administrators is the lack of teacher skill on how to fully integrate and leverage their mobile devices within learning. After that are some of the more traditional things that we've thought about, network security issues, the challenge of having multiple platforms, and again, that digital equity component comes up as well. So what we're going to do now is that we're going to engage my panel a little bit in some conversation around mobile learning and get some of their perspectives into it before we go on to the next area. So what I want to do is I want to start over here with my friends from Jamestown. And Camilla, you're doing some really interesting things with mobile devices. I've had the opportunity to come to Jamestown and visit many of your classrooms. Give us just a thumbnail sketch of some of the types of devices that you're using at Jamestown Elementary School from a mobile standpoint. These are devices that you're providing to the students.
The majority of them we provide, we have them sort of full sets, but we do allow for some of these devices to come in, and I think we're preparing for an environment that students can bring in their own devices,
which we're hearing all across the country as well. But Angela, I did have the opportunity to go into your classroom and see some of the amazing things that you're doing with your special education students. Devices. So why don't you give us a little bit of a sketch in terms of an example, maybe?
Well, I have worked with children this year, kindergarten through second grade, and a lot of the reasons why our children are not accessing the curriculum are, for my students, this particular population, they have high intelligence, but because of fine motor or gross motor difficulties, and have a hard time accessing paper and pencil, or even just being able to look at a computer screen down the keyboard is difficult for some of them. So I use iPads and iPod touches in my classroom for an accessibility tool for them to access the internet, to be able to write. There are too many applications on the iPads that inhibit their writing, kind of guess what they're writing in numbers. We also use them for students to publish their own work. Draw and integrate things together. It's also a big motivating tool for our students. A lot of learning is hard for them, so they're given a piece of paper and pencil, and they're kind of, it's hard for them, so they're kind of done and lost. So the motivating factor is there. Cool iPad. Everyone wants to be like them now. So.
It was amazing to see all the wonderful things you're doing in the classroom. Now, Ryan, you and I have talked about mobile learning for years. We have been having this ongoing conversation about mobile learning. So let me ask you the tough question. So let's try it again, Julie. At Padapsico High School.
It's just fine, Julie. That sounds great.
Okay. You're humoring me now. Can our students bring their own devices?
Yes.
Okay. What's that look like?
It can sometimes look very scary. And oftentimes look chaotic, but we're piloting this year an approach that allows students to bring their own devices in, and we're a 4x4 school, so we change classes very few times, and so we talked about what that meant in terms of student use, and in my school district, it's often been the process, and still is on paper, Our policy says that if you bring a cell phone to school, you're going to get suspended. That's what the policy says. It's not feasible, it's not practical to implement that policy. And that's been, and that policy is being looked at. So we're looking at where to go with that as a district. So we're piloting an approach that allows students to bring those devices, use them for music during the change of classes. They're even allowed to text between the change of classes. They're allowed to use it during lunch for gaming or texting. They can't talk on the device. That's our one thing that we don't allow them to do. And then in the classrooms themselves, depending on the subject area and what the teacher and how the teacher wants to integrate that device, they're welcome to integrate those devices into instruction. What we have done, though, to tie in this whole piece is deal with the issue of cyberbullying, because that's a concern. And so we've also done quite a bit of training and workshops with our students themselves about the issues regarding cyberbullying and cyber safety, and also brought in parents and the community into that discussion as well.
So you actually use the opportunity for the students to use their own devices as sort of the jumping off point for that cyberbullying conversation?
Correct. Yeah, because I mean, let's not kid ourselves. We have that issue. I mean, those things are happening. Students, when it happens in cyberspace, they can't get away from it. Is one of the challenges, because they're not going to stop being on Facebook. They're not going to stop accessing their technology. So we have to have that conversation with them and deal with it in peer mediation scenarios and in ways that help students understand and be more educated in that process. And when we go through that process, typically, students understand the balances, and then we can use those devices more effectively in school.
So how has this concept of either bring your own device or bring your own technology, how's that worked with your teachers? How do your teachers feel about that?
So when we brought this to the faculty last year, there was instant pushback. It's not going to work. Students shouldn't even bring them to school. And the question back to the faculty is, do you have yours? Do you use yours during the day? And the answer is they can't give theirs up. So why should we be asking our students to give theirs up as well? And through a back and forth process, we came to agreement that we would give this a try, that we would see how it worked this year and see if we could be effective with it. And it's worked. You know, one of the challenges is back to the sort of the digital divide issue.
Right.
And so we've addressed that in classrooms by ensuring that it's in a collaborative scenario.
Okay.
Now, you can't expect every student to have those devices. Right. But we do have wireless access in the building. It's fairly good. I feel comfortable about saying our teachers feel comfortable with it. But every once in a while, it doesn't work. And it's wonderful to have the ability to go to those devices. And for those students who have unlimited access on their smartphones, to jump on 3G or 4G and get the access they need in order to continue the lesson going. And it happens all the time.
Ryan just brought up a really good point. I remember you and I talking last year about this idea of developing collaboration around using some of the mobile devices, and you actually thought that was a very positive way to start approaching it. Around the mobile devices, rather than having students all have one to one.
Well, we see a lot of power in not serving one to one, per se, but have students who can work in either smaller groups or pairs or information or in centers and sort of accessing the information and training together. It often makes a stronger product, and it often makes a better working environment for both students and teachers. And also we sort of get away from the delivery method to the students driving some of the instructional scenarios.
I like the idea of the devices enabling.
That's right. We don't necessarily think that one-to-one device is necessarily the most successful way of doing this, because that will go back to lonely work. Then we sort of look at that everybody has a piece of paper. But rather to really do what the technology does really well, which is work in the transformation and developing creative solutions or products.
I also integrate in the general classroom with my students, and we had the opportunity for Camilla's help this year
to online learning and blended learning, but remember, we have time at the end for questions, so we can always come back to mobile learning. And don't worry, Janie and Jennifer are getting
there. Don't worry.
Don't worry at all. All right, we're going to talk about online and blended learning, and we're going to do another question. So you should already be set up. If you haven't already gone to question two, you need to go back there. Okay. So this question is, you can't see it very well, but what percentage of administrators have taken an online class on their own to improve their own skills? So we're talking about administrators taking an online class. Is it 11%, 21%, 34%, and 46%? So if you stay within the assessment, you shouldn't need to put that answer number back in. Okay, so we've got some people voting here. I got my answer. So I can share with you.
So once you answer that question, just click that next bit, that arrow, and it'll send you to the next question. Don't answer that one yet. But that sends us the data.
But she said she's right.
Okay, so let's go ahead. Oh, good. There we go. So again, we have like a really eclectic group here because we're all over the board in terms of our responses. It looks like about a quarter of folks think it was option C, 34%. Smaller group thought it was 21%. It looks like the majority thought it was D, 46%. Now we're talking about administrators taking an online course on their own to develop their skills. So the correct answer, the survey says, it's 21%. So 21% of administrators told us that they've taken an online class. Now back to my reoccurring theme of all the interesting things that librarians are doing. Librarians actually were the 34%. So 34% of librarians said that they've taken an online class on their own. It actually was 11% of high school students told us they've taken an online class on their own, not directed by school at all. We think that's really interesting. Okay. Okay, so we talked about in our last report student and parent interest in online learning. I just wanted to bring that back for you in terms of the context. We asked students, so if you've not taken an online class, are you interested in taking an online class? And you can see almost, you know, with a little bit of degradation here from high school down to elementary grades, but almost around averaging about a third of students, elementary through high school, said they'd like to take an online class. And when we asked parents about recommending online learning as a good investment for their school or district to make, you can see a third of parents put online learning at the top of their list in terms of the type of investments that they think their school should be making. We asked teachers, given all of that interest, we asked teachers also about their interest, particularly in teaching an online class. And that's the one I want to draw your eye to right here. So right here we asked teachers, how interested are you in teaching an online class? Now some of you may not be surprised at this data. The teachers with the last 6 years of experience were actually the ones that were much more interested in teaching an online class. So it looks to us as if it were a district and we're thinking about who is our pool of likely recruit for teaching online class. It's under 10 years of experience and then it drops off. We still, though, should note that even despite that, even looking at those brand new teachers, still a third of them, even under 10 years of experience, said, I'm not interested at all in teaching an online class. Now, given the demand that we have, the increasing demand every year for online classes by students and parents, that's creating an issue in many schools and districts. How do we match up that supply and demand? So for the very first time, we asked teachers, so what would motivate you to teach an online class? And we took a range of different incentives and motivations to ask them. Now this one column over here, let me step over here and show you this. This column is all teachers right here. This column is teachers that have already taught an online class. So what would motivate them to teach again? And these are teachers that have taken online professional development. So the question was, is online professional development a stepping stone, shall we say, to teaching an online class? Well, the first thing we see is that actually, in terms of the rank, all of these particular motivators were almost exactly the same. It was just a matter of intensity. So the idea of having an increased compensation, improved work conditions, being provided with the technology to facilitate teaching and online class and working with motivated students was really the things that were driving teachers. What I thought was equally interesting, and it's noted in the report, are the ones that didn't show up on the list near the top at all. So the idea, for example, of increased prestige or recognition by being an online teacher didn't carry any weight with the teachers across the board. The idea of working with gifted or at-risk students didn't carry any weight either. So these were really the types of things that were interesting. The other one that we thought was interesting is that, and I know it's a little hard to see here, is that we asked those teachers, so if having, do you think having a personal experience with taking an online class would motivate you? They in fact put that as fairly low ranking on the ranking. So we really need to think, I believe, as a nation and our schools and districts need to think a little bit more creatively about how to address this issue of matching up the supply and the demand with online learning. So let's get into that conversation about online learning a little bit here. Now, Janie, tell us a little bit about what types of online learning, either from a student standpoint or a teacher professional development standpoint, that you're facilitating through Maryland.
Okay, we have what's called the Maryland Virtual Learning Opportunities Program, and that is student courses and teacher online professional development. We're really at an infancy stage with it because of lack of funding. Most states that have really robust virtual learning programs have had a substantial amount of seed money from the state to get them going until they can do a model where they're self-sustained. And we haven't had that in Maryland, so we've been kind of cobbling together bits of money. And we've actually used, one of the things that you talk about here is being able to grow your online teachers. And in Maryland, we have created courses in facilitating online courses and facilitating online. And we also use the EDC's courses out of Boston for teaching online. And if we have an online teacher, and we sort of tap teachers to go into this, and we've been part of a program, federal program, e-learning for educators, excuse me, it's the allergy community, that is a partnership between state departments of ed and public television stations, and we've actually created courses for students and we've created professional development courses for teachers that we can offer. But we've tapped teachers to become the online teachers, and in order to be an online teacher in Maryland for student-oriented teacher courses, you have to have taken an online course. You have to have gone through a facilitation course, and it can be hours, it can be another one that you've taken, and then you also have to have a shadowing experience with an online teacher so that people can really understand if this is what they want to get into. Because sometimes the misconception is it's easier to teach an online course because you're home in your bunny slippers at night.
Yeah.
But you're really more available to your students, whether they're adults or whether they're students, when you're taking an online course. Mm-hmm. So through the e-learning for educators programming grant and through our ed tech funds where we've created courses, we've actually paid for a large number of Maryland teachers to go through the whole process to become online teachers. So we're growing our own pool of teachers.
Mm-hmm. And that gets right back to, in the report, I didn't put it up here as one of our data points for today, is that when we asked administrators, what's your biggest concern about online courses? Administrators talked about the quality of that interaction between the student and the teacher. So the idea of very comprehensively training the teacher on how to teach online is an important part of that conversation.
It is, and not every teacher is comfortable, even
right.
if they become fairly good at it. They're not all comfortable teaching online. They really need to feed off that face-to-face interaction.
So I have a question here for all of our panelists. Have any of you taken an online class?
Mm-hmm.
Yes. Jennifer, tell us about your online class.
Part of my degree was done online through Rutgers University.
Okay.
Really enjoyed doing that because, again, I was a late-night person, was able to have the flexibility. And in Fairfax County Public Schools, there's an entire online campus where mm-hmm. students are able to take a lot of their coursework online. There's a lot of professional courses that are available through something called eLearnIT or eLearnIt, and there's a lot of our courses that are mandated that our teachers can go through that process. And last year, for the first time, our ESOL students at the high school level, their summer school, because of the cuts in funding, they shifted the program to completely online, and there was a synchronous and asynchronous portion of that online summer school for ESOL students. So there's a lot of exciting things happening. It's just, again, funding those programs and and being creative. But yeah, I think the online piece is something that's really going to be something that we need to keep our eyes on, because our assistant superintendent for instruction is very interested in having all of our students have an online experience before they graduate. And with the new course requirement on personal finance, there's some talk about creating that as an online course, and that would be one way of getting all of our kids to have an online experience prior to going off into the world.
Julie,
yes,
I was just going to say the vast majority of my young teachers, all of my young teachers, I would say 90% of my young teachers are choosing online cohorts to pursue their continuing education.
Yes,
without
yes,
question.
Across the board. So my second question to my panel is, any of you ever taught an online class?
No? I'm teaching now for the University of Maryland University College. In their graduate program in instructional technology with educators. And I finished my third course that I taught, and I'm teaching again this semester, and I absolutely love it.
You
do? But when I went through their orientation, I dropped out the first time, thought, I can't do this. I hate it, hate it, hate it. But then I thought, no, I'm not going to let this get me. And I went to take it again with a different teacher, and
okay.
It was a totally different experience, and I loved every minute of it.
Hold your questions on online learning. So we're going to talk about digital content. And the first thing we're going to do is our third question now. And this question is a fill in the blank. You know, we have to have all sorts of different questions on our little assessment here. 70% of who say that animations and simulations should be an essential part of the ultimate digital or textbook. Elementary students, middle school students, high school librarians, or parents. So go ahead and choose your response. 70% of those cohort, which cohort is it? Is strongly in favor of animations and simulations.
For this question, when you click the blue arrow, it'll take you to a screen and
are
it'll say submit.
Are you looking at the
answer?
No. We only have one. Did you think we were cheating?
I did.
Well, when you bring smartphones into the classroom, there's
we are collaborating.
Just in case the audience is concerned that I have panelists that are collaborating on the answer, all three of the questions I asked you, the data is not in the report. Okay, so let's take a look at what we got here. Again, we're kind of all over the board. Isn't that interesting? We've got some folks that say it was the younger students, the older students, the middle school students, the librarians, and also the parents. So let's see what the real answer is.
You can stop the assessment now.
Oh, I can stop the assessment. Right. Yeah. Okay, great. Thank you. Okay, so actually what the answer is, and this may come as a surprise to some of you, that 70% think animations and simulations, it's librarians. Actually, when we look at elementary students, middle school students, high school students, and parents, it's all about the same. It's averages out to be about 40%. So a nice strong number. But how interesting that the librarians are really out in front in terms of the use of some of this digital content. So let's talk a little bit more about the whole digital content conversation here, because it is really interesting. One of the things that we've been asking students over the last couple of years, and parents, is that we ask them to help us design the ultimate e-textbook. And we ask them what types of features and functionality. And that's documented in the student report as well. Basically, what the students tell us is that they're looking for highly interactive, real-world-based experiences. They're looking for something that can provide tools to facilitate collaboration and have customizable features that personalize learning. What students tell us they are not looking for is a CD that comes with the textbook, nor are they looking for a digital reader that, again, is just replicating the textbook. They're really looking for a different type of interactive experience. Textbook probably isn't even the germane word to be using anymore, but we're using it as a placeholder. We asked teachers what types of digital content they're using in the classroom right now. And so I know it's a little hard to see, but this first column is elementary teachers, middle school teachers, high school teachers. And then we asked librarians, what types of digital content are you recommending for your teachers to use? So we saw a little bit of a difference here. So we see, obviously, the elementary teachers are doing more game-based environments than the middle school and high school teachers. Lots of interest in online textbooks all the way across the board. We're seeing a little bit more podcasts and video work done at high school than at middle school and the younger grades. The one that we thought was so interesting was that across the board here, you can see there's a lot of lineup between what the librarians are recommending and maybe what the teachers are using, except when we're talking about the use of real-time data in the classroom. So it looks like we still have some more work to do with our teachers in terms of how to effectively integrate real-time data, whether that is scientific data coming from NASA, whether it is GIS types of things that are coming from Google Maps. But it does look like our librarians are actually the ones that are pushing that envelope a little bit more in the individual classrooms. We asked administrators and technology coordinators, what's holding back the greater adoption or integration of digital content within instruction? And again, we were polling technology coordinators as well as administrators. And again, we see this issue of the lack of teacher skills. So just having the digital content, if we have the animations and simulations, how do we really make sure that teachers are using those effectively? And then also we asked both teachers and administrators, so when you're evaluating the use of digital content in the classroom, what types of factors are most important to you? And this is where we see one of those classic speak-up disconnects between our cohorts. And so we see some really interesting things happening here. So these are principals, and these are teachers. So principals, the number one quality characteristic, shall we say, for a principal is student achievement results. So if we're using this particular piece of digital content, what's the proven result of using that? That's really the number one factor there for the principals. Same for district administrators as well. However, when we ask the teachers that same question, we see a couple different responses come up. For the teachers, what's most important is that it's created by a teacher, it's free, and it's been referred by a colleague. That's the way they're defining the quality characteristics. And as you can see, so we have some different types of responses there. The other one that we thought was really interesting is that there was universal acceptance about the idea of whoever the publishing organization was it a credible publishing organization in terms of that particular piece of content? So we thought that was interesting. The other thing that we thought was interesting is that we asked the librarians a slightly different question. I'm going to get Jen's input into this in a moment. So we're sort of calling it the librarian evaluation rubric. We asked the librarian, so when you're recommending content to be used, digital content to be used by your teachers, what's sort of the filter you're going through in terms of identifying what's high quality content? And you can see the numbers are really high, but the things that came up for the librarians were the accuracy of the content, the ease of use by teachers and students, alignment to curriculum standards, the credibility of the publishing organization, the cost, and the level of engagement and interactivity. And what we thought was absolutely fascinating is that if we keep in mind, the teachers were telling us that they wanted to make sure that it worked. That was where their referral was by the colleague. They wanted to make sure it worked. The administrators wanted to make sure it had strong student achievement results. We actually had that in the librarians, because we have here the alignment to curriculum standards as driving us in terms of results. The idea of it being accurate and ease of use gets us right to that aspect of, is it really going to work when I use it in my classroom? And then the other piece I love is the level of engagement and interactivity, which is what we heard from the students. So we see now in this librarian rubric kind of a blending of all three of those other cohorts, their concern areas. So let's talk a little bit about that. So Jen, I'm going right to you on this one.
Okay. So how we're selecting digital content?
Sure, thanks.
Well, I'm really excited to see that that laid out in the report, because really the accuracy of the content is a battle that librarians have to face with students who are in the Google age. So they Google everything. Students just, teachers, we all do. Google, I'm not, this is not a knock on Google. I really love Google. But we also, as educators, pay for publishers' database products, perhaps, that are edited by experts and that we feel are clearly more accurate and safer to use in terms of research. So that's the first piece. So when we're talking about accuracy, as well as much of our scientific data goes out of date so quickly that traditional print publishers can't maintain, and you don't have the funding to continually update a print collection. So we're really focusing in on that updatable, accurate kind of content. And also, we have to provide training for our teachers in our buildings as librarians as well. So we really want it to be fairly an out-of-the-box product that it's pretty intuitive to use for both students and for teachers. Because if the teachers feel that frustration, they're not going to incorporate that. They're going to go back to something they've been using for years. And our goal is to help move them forward in using these very current resources. And so those pieces are really key. And also promoting, ultimately, you know, it has to match curriculum, because the school librarian mission is to find resources to support all of your curriculum that's taught in the building. And so those three elements together are huge. And the fact that there's a tremendous demand from teachers for students to be able to have access to multimedia clips, images, videos, a lot of variety of resources. And so we really do look for products that are going to have elements that can be pulled for student projects, as well as will be interactive somewhat for students. But ultimately, really, top dog is the accuracy. Those were absolutely reflective, I think, of librarians. Really, I think it was really well done.
It was interesting because we started to see coming up through, and once again, this is the very first time we've polled the librarian, so it'll be interesting to see how this is going to be changing. But we started to see this emerging role of the librarian is not just enabling the teacher by providing the content, but actually doing a lot more empowerment in terms of helping them identify different types of resources and how they can find those resources. And so a really interesting role. Now, Jamie, you have responsibility for the school libraries as well. What are you seeing or hearing from your schools in terms of a changing role for librarians or their interaction with digital content today?
Well, it is tremendous. The librarians aren't the way they used to be anymore, just concerned with books and literature. We have in Maryland the MDK-12 Digital Library, in which all the library administrators got together and decided to pull together for better buying power when they're buying the online resources. So all school systems have online resources as a result of that, and it's the librarians who are trying to make sure the teachers are being able to engage with that and the students being able to engage with those resources themselves. At the state level, we really are pushing for less textbook-driven, more digital content-driven schools. And we're about to come out with a report on technology, and that's one of the key pieces. Actually, everything you've talked about, online learning, digital content, and mobile technologies are the basis for this report. But the digital content piece is really a fundamental piece of all of that. And a textbook that's electronic is not it's like a print textbook. Let's move away from textbooks completely and go to more dynamic kinds of digital content.
It's really a whole new, different type of syllabus. Now, Ryan, you and I have had like a really brief conversation, so I'm probably putting you on the spot here about the fact that you're going to be piloting.
We are piloting.
You are piloting right now.
The course is running right now. It's a pre-college science course designed for our what we typically consider a standard level student. In Maryland, you have to have 3 science credits to graduate from high school. So typically, your students have taken biology, and most likely they've taken something like earth science. So the design is working with the Community College of Baltimore County. We wanted to develop a course that would help transition students into the community college experience so they would be prepared, and the community college would feel comfortable with them coming into the community college with an extended science background. So the course is completely designed in the e-textbook form, and we use Microsoft Reader to develop the course. It's all built around 18 scientists. And so each chapter is about a scientist, and then it goes through those, it talks about their theories, and then you have virtual labs and then hands-on labs in the science classroom. It's problem-based. It's really quite exciting. It's basically physics, biology, and chemistry all combined into a course to help prepare students for that college experience. But it is not at all like a textbook like we know it to be. And it was developed in-house because we could not find anything that met the needs, in-house meaning Baltimore County.
Right.
And we're piloting it with Catonsville High School. Mm-hmm. But my science teachers, along with the Catonsville science teachers, developed the content. Or found the content and built it around a course. And much of it came from the MD.
We don't have the right language for any of
yeah.
these things.
And much of that content comes from exactly what Janie was talking about,
right.
the library and the resources that we have available free of charge.
We've been doing some really interesting focus group work with students. I did with Eric at the Tigerwoods Learning Center here in D.C. around students' ideas for digital content in terms of what types of content they want to use, how they want to access it. It's actually very, very interesting. All right, what I'm going to do is I'm keeping my eye on the clock. I want to run through that ultimate vision, the ultimate school vision, and then we're going to open it up for questions. So we talked about the three components of the student vision of socially literacy, untethered, and visually rich. And so in the ultimate school question, what we're looking for is really, do we have a shared vision going forward? You know, are we on the same page in terms of what types of technology we think have a great impact for learning? And so what we did is that we took mobile learning, the online and blended learning, and visually content, and we pulled out the responses from that question for middle school students, high school students, teachers, and principals. To see whether we were on the same page. Now, as you can imagine, they're very interesting, not a big surprise. Two-thirds of middle school and high school students say, let me bring my own device to school, and yet only a third of teachers and parents are buying into that concept. So I think we sort of discussed that. Some of the other things we see, though, is like the idea of laptops within instruction has a lot of resonance amongst all the different respondents. When we look at this idea of engaging online learning, we start to see, again, some differences. We see that particularly students are interested in chat rooms that have video capability so that they can collaborate and chat with other students, both at their school as well as remotely. Our teachers and principals are not necessarily buying into that concept at this point. However, this idea of online tutors as being part of the online learning experience does have a lot of resonance. It does look like we're on basically the same page associated with that. And then finally, in terms of digital content, what we've just been discussing, the idea of having campus-wide internet access, whether that's Wi-Fi or some other type of broadband access, is something that all of these different groups, students, teachers, and parents are buying into. This idea, again, of games and virtual simulation is more the purview of the students than it is of the teachers and the parents. I didn't have my librarian data up here, otherwise you could see that being totally off the chart as well. So really what it comes down to is this idea of enabling, engaging, and empowering learning. And as you will see in the report, we give you many, many examples of how teachers are doing that, how administrators are doing that, and how librarians are doing that. So as I said, I promised you I would save some time for your comments, your questions. Please feel free to tap into any of our panelists if you'd like. Does anyone have any questions at this time? Yes, Ron.
The question is for Ryan, and it goes back to the mobile learning that you're piloting in your school, because we're from Baltimore City, so we're neighbors. And I was curious as to know how you guys are handling the equity issue with the mobile devices. Like, are there any students that are not bringing the smartphones to school, and do you find that there's an imbalance between what they're able to do in classrooms with or without the device?
All the teachers, so first of all, let me preface by saying that there's no mandate that everybody in every classroom uses them.
Okay.
So it's in the classrooms where a teacher finds it appropriate to use those devices, and they can make it work where equity is not a factor. So whether that's through, like we were doing here, the three of us together answered those three questions.
Okay.
Because Jennifer and Janie didn't have their smartphone with them. Janie, do you have a smartphone?
I have a dumb phone.
Yeah. So that's when I go into classrooms where students are using their smartphones. That's what I'm seeing, because
okay.
there's never a case where everyone has them.
Okay.
But there's a lot who have them.
Yeah.
I am shocked at the, you know, that number is just going to continue to skyrocket.
Mm-hmm.
So, and students bring them. You know, we were just saying here, well, you know, the issues over theft and cheating came up, and you know, my quick response to cheating is if it just takes a picture on a teacher's test, and then you can share that around, and every student can pass, something's wrong with the test. Something's going on with the instruction and the assessment. So let the cheating happen in that case, because the teacher needs to know that something needs to happen with the instruction and the assessment piece there. When it comes to theft, that's going to happen whether you involve them in instruction or not. You know, that we had theft last year when they weren't involved in instruction. It hasn't gone up at all. So.
I just wonder if you just guess can talk about, you didn't really say about the parent side, but some of your teachers' feedback when they jumped in when you piloted this. What was the feedback from your parents positive, and especially what were the parents that weren't excited in it? And also, do you have any issues around the fact that they're paying for data plans essentially for other kids to use their kids' phone? Any of those issues come up?
Not with the data piece.
Okay.
Now, we started this before there were some of those changes with the data plan, you know, like for instance with the iPhone and
right.
how that operates. So I don't know if that will shift as time goes on. There wasn't an issue with the data piece.
Okay.
I will tell you, we get more pushback from an administrative standpoint dealing with discipline. For instance, last year, if we took a phone from a student who was texting their mom or dad, the parent was furious with us. So to spin that, that's freed up. Because because the parents and students all know that between the class changes or during their lunchtime, if they need to contact their parent via text message, which they all do, then they have the freedom to do that. And we're not standing in their way or saying that if you do that, you're going to be in trouble or suspended. There are parents there's always going to be parents who question the policy and the practice. I always, anytime that comes up, have one-on-one conversations with them and invite them in, you know, walk around, see what it looks like. If you're not comfortable with it, then we need to have more conversations. But I think you'll find it comfortable.
Noah, now you said you started to allow students to learn more about it. This is an elementary school. Did you get any pushback from parents on that?
No, we informed them what we were going to do. Some of the questions came up, what are you going to do with it? We handled yes in the classroom. Not from the parents' perspective, they don't understand the instructional value of the activity. And it's not to be informed about the purpose for this. We have not had any problems. We are preparing for with the infrastructure and all that, to do a bring your own anytime, any device, anywhere learning. So we'll know very soon.
You indicated that you have surveyed urban, rural, suburban, children in poverty, children in wealth.
Yeah.
Do you see major differences there that we're not hearing because we're talking about Fairfax County and...
No, actually not. When we, one of our largest respondents to the survey is Chicago Public Schools. And so it's amazing to look at the student data, particularly on personal access to devices. And we see very little differences, whether the child is in rural Mississippi, you know, suburban Fairfax, or in terms of Chicago Public Schools. We actually don't see those differences. Where we do see differences, which I always think is really interesting, is on the educator side. So we do see that we still see some of those traditional differences, whether it's a Title I school, a majority minority school, or a particular demographic population. On the educator side, but the students actually are having a very universal experience. And what is very interesting about the mobile devices is that even despite being from a challenged home, students are finding a way to get those particular devices. If you were with us for the April 1st student-parent presentation, you saw some of our newest data, which two-thirds of parents said that they go and buy some kind of mobile device for their child to use in school if it could be used for instructional purposes. And when you disaggregate that parent data by that same urban, rural, suburban, Title I, we didn't see any difference in that data either. Yes? I know.
My question is for Jennifer. For the virtual online campus, what learning assistance do you
use? Well, they use Blackboard in Fairfax County. Since I'm not part of the online campus, maybe I'm sure that the students have to, there is a synchronous part of that. It's completely separate from our traditional high schools. Dirk, do you know what they use? I'm sorry.
Blackboard.
Just Blackboard and And eliminate, yeah. So those are the two. Yeah, we've been training and eliminate and doing a lot of remote training on certain products, including our latest technology scaffolding. Trying to do some training so that our elementary school teachers are being brought up to speed in terms of what we want our kids to be doing in terms of technology.
So I guess my second part of that, since you're using Blackboard, are they using Blackboard mobile? Do
they
have access to that?
I'm not exactly sure. I know that, I will say that students across Fairfax County, if you go on a Google search, is that, Fairfax, the FCPS 24/7 is like one of the, first hits on Google in our area. And so they're constantly using it for all sorts of course management issues. Every single teacher is really required to be using Blackboard, and there's a varying degree to expertise in which teachers will be using it. But it is, and not only that, but they've also, parents have their own Blackboard account, which they can then also access, have a gateway into seeing their students' assignments as well as direct feedback right to their teachers. And it's very, very much a connected community. Blackboard's been really, really useful. And many of our products that we've purchased from the library side have the ability to have a persistent links to resources that can be embedded into Blackboard for instructional purposes. So there's a lot of features that we are using Blackboard for, and that it really is a nice connection between some of our library products and the traditional curriculum as well. So it all sort of comes together. In addition, we have it's something called eCard, which houses our own curriculum assessments and resources, and that also connects back into Blackboard. So it's fairly a large project.
And Fairfax has been, I believe, a Blackboard customer since like 2001 or 2002. I mean, I was speaking with some of your Fairfax people yesterday about the whole history associated with that. Yes.
What are the implications of all this for engagement and for pedagogy and for curriculum? But what about assessing? How will assessing have to be different based on all of these changes?
The only thing I can really speak to is that with Common Core, and we're part of the CAR Consortium for Common Core, they're looking to try to develop more performance-based dynamic kinds of tests so that it's not multiple choice fill in the bubble, but that there are some ways for students to demonstrate their mastery. And I think that's where we need to go. With assessing technology, but we're not really assessing the technology, we're assessing the learning of whatever content. Excuse me. When we first started with online testing in Maryland, we also were at the point where we needed to measure student technology use, and we tried to get it embedded, but the psychometricians told us you can't do that, you can't measure two different things. So we're hoping that they can work this out so that we can, as they take the online tests and as they're working with the digital content in classrooms, we can truly say that our students are technology literate because of all of the kinds of activities and the follow-up assessments that go along with that.
Is CARP talking to teachers and librarians about this in Maryland?
Well, CARP is still at a fairly early stage. We have people at the State Department that are serving on the CARP committees, and we're at this point pushing out information to school systems. They will be involved as part of our Race to the Top application initiative. We have what's called for the next 4 years Educator Effectiveness Academies and teams, and there will be over 6,000 educators coming to these, and they're going to be learning about Common Core. And as we know more about the CARP assessment, which in a way is backwards, if you look at backward design, we should have done the assessments first, but that's another story. But they will be learning about whatever we know about the CARP assessment at that time. Teams from each school are coming with the principal, an English language arts teacher, mathematics teacher, and then somebody that's going to be representing STEM for that school. Some schools have a STEM person, many don't. So it may be a science teacher. In many cases, it's the library, not many. In some cases, it's the library media specialist that's coming, because that's the person in the school that can really bring all curriculum together in an interdisciplinary way.
You bring up a really good point, and I don't like to sort of preview stuff for Speak Up 2011, but brought that up a little bit. We will be having some questions this year about assessment on Speak Up 2011, and we are actually going to be spending some time doing that. All right, Gideon's got the last question, but then we'll all hang around in case we want to ask more questions.
Hi, Gideon Sanders from McKinley Tech. This is actually a question for Ryan. As we continue to look to integrate technology within the classroom, personal technology, so that the burden doesn't completely fall on the school, this is a two-part question. How do you allow for social networking and within the constraints of SIPA and the regulations? And the second part of that is, what efforts do you make to show the power of social media, not just from, hey, how are you doing, from a friend, but more if you look at the Ezra Abdel Fattah from Egypt, who started the revolution against Mubarak through Facebook, those kind of uses of it.
So the second part of your question, I'm a Tascal High School, and then there's an AND, Center for the Arts. So I'm both a comprehensive and a magnet school. And so my magnet programs, I have 1,000 students who belong in my building, 500 belong, meaning they're my comprehensive kids. I have 500 students who are magnet students who audition from all around the county to come into my school. We need to recruit. So we use Facebook and Twitter as a recruitment tool right now. However, at the same time that we do that, we also have had experiences just this year where fake Facebook accounts have been created, bash these students at, Patasco, whatever it is, at Facebook, and they create fan pages for that kind of thing. So that's all part of that, cyberbullying conversation we have with kids and kind of break down those conversations. The first part is, I think when it comes to using social networking, in Baltimore, the Baltimore County Public Schools uses PBWorks as a large implementation countywide, where all teachers can have PBWorks sites and use the tools in a wiki environment to help support their classrooms. At my school, we also invest in Edline so we do digital content, locker boxes, those kinds of things, conversations that frame around instruction, but we have not branched off that allow those conversations to occur between teacher and student in Facebook, as an example, in terms of that social networking environment. And we're pretty leery to allow that to occur at this point.
So we're going to make that the last comment, though we will hang around a little bit. I do want to thank you all for staying with us right till the end. It has been great to have this opportunity to release this data. This presentation will be up on our website later on this afternoon, if you want to access it, as well as the report itself. And then with our wonderful help from Angela from McKinley Tech High School, hopefully we'll also have a video. Thank you, Angela, for coming and being our videographer today. So please congratulate my panel on all of their work. And here's a page from Kathy Bird's book. Let's not just walk out of here and say, hey, that was interesting. Let's take it and use this data in some way to enable, engage, and empower learning.